Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books, and this week I'm very, very pleased to say we have Richard Weikart on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, Hitler's Ethic, The Nazi Pursuit of Evolutionary Progress. I really like this book a lot. It does, I think, wonders for clearing up what Hitler thought and why, which I think is kind of a confusing subject, especially given the amount that Hitler said and wrote. He's not always completely consistent, but I think Richard does a terrific job of, as I said, kind of bringing it all together and laying bare the kind of intellectual roots of his worldview, I guess I would call it that. So, Richard, thank you first for writing the book.
Well, thanks for having me on here today.
Yeah, well, it's terrific. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm a professor of history at California State University, Stanislaus. I got my PhD at University of Iowa in 1994. And while I was working on my dissertation, I actually wasn't really thinking much about the Nazi period per se. I mean, I studied it in the course of studying modern German history, of course, but I was more focused on the late 19th century and intellectual history there. And as I began doing some studies into the history of Darwinism in the late 19th century, my dissertation was on how the socialists, especially the Marxists, from Marx to Bernstein, received Darwinism. I began noticing that there were a lot of biologists, social thinkers who were trying to use Darwinism to establish a new kind of ethics to replace Judeo-Christian ethics or even Kantian or utilitarian ethics with this new kind of evolutionary ethics. And so I became interested in that as a research topic after I finished my dissertation. And so as I began researching that, I started finding out that a lot of the people who were doing evolutionary ethics or writing about evolutionary ethics in early 19th century Germany were eugenicists. And so that got me fascinated about the intersection of bioethics with evolutionary ethics. And so that sort of turned my research in a somewhat different direction at that point. And so as I was teaching courses, I was teaching a course here also on the Nazi period and teaching courses on European intellectual history, and I became interested and then fascinated about how this intersection took place between evolutionary ethics and eugenics, and then also euthanasia came into the scene, especially since one of the leading German Darwinists was the first person in German discourse to propose killing the disabled and gave evolutionary explanations for that. I became very fascinated with this notion of evolutionary ethics and trying to see how it played itself out in late 19th and early 20th century Germany. Most of what I was looking at, though, is, again, still late 19th century. I wasn't really, and before World War I was really my focus at that point. So that was really where my research was focused at that. In fact, I thought Nazism was sort of an overworked field, something I wasn't really wanting to get into at that point. So I sort of got pushed kicking and screaming toward the Nazi period in some ways. But I began noticing the strong parallels between the evolutionary ethics that I was studying in the late 19th century and Nazi ideology. And so I wanted to then see, was there really that parallel, that resonation between Nazi ideology and some of the evolutionary ethics I was looking at. Of course, the answer to that, as I came to discover, was yes, there was. Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing took place, though, too, that was quite striking was, and this sort of brings it into sort of looking at contemporary issues, I was teaching a seminar in 1995, I think it was, early 1995, about evolution, religion, and society. And in that, I read a book with my class by a philosopher named James Rachels, and the book is called Created from Animals, The Moral Implications of Darwinism. Mm-hmm. And in that book, Rachels makes the philosophical argument that the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic is dead because of Darwinism.
I'm sorry to just break up laughing.
And
that's pretty funny.
That position, by the way, is very close to the position of Peter Singer, who is an endowed chair at Princeton University in bioethics. Singer takes a very similar position, although Singer hasn't written a whole book about it. But he does, on occasion, sprinkled throughout his writings, mention the fact that Darwinism should have already buried the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic, and he's hoping that he now can deliver the final death blow to it. And thus he sanctions infanticide, euthanasia, abortion, and also animal rights, interestingly, all of which were things that, or many of these were things that actually have interesting parallels. And Singer, of course, his grandparents perished in the Holocaust, actually. Obviously, Singer's not a Nazi by as far stretch of the imagination, but still there's some strange parallels going on here. So I decided to explore this aspect of the bioethics and looking at the euthanasia and other kinds of issues and how these all played themselves out relating to the Nazi period. Yeah. That's sort of how I came to the book Hitler's Ethic. Now, actually, I wrote in 2004, I published an earlier work called From Darwin to Hitler that looked at the late 19th century and evolutionary ethics and eugenics and racism in Germany from the time of the 1860s, early 1860s on up until World War I. And only the last chapter actually dealt with Hitler, but it did draw that connection then with Hitler there right at the end. And then Hitler's Ethic then takes that last chapter and expands it into full-length piece.
Well, you know, regarding Singer, I can tell you this, after many years in academia, the best way to draw attention to yourself in academia is to say outrageous and probably untrue things. I don't do that, so nobody knows who I am. And I don't have an endowed chair at Princeton. But I'm quite happy with my living here. So you've answered my question about why you wrote the book. One of the things I really like about the book is the very first chapter, and you ask a question which I think should be asked at the beginning of every intellectual history, and that is, why the heck should we believe the person about whom this book is? That is to say, why should we believe Hitler? Because we know he was a liar. I mean, he did lie a lot. I mean, we just know that. I mean, that's definitely true. So, and you asked this question. It's a really good question. I had never thought about it. Why believe what he wrote when we know that he, in occasions, flat out lied? So could you address that, please?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing. When you deal with the issue of propaganda, and you have to tease this out, because there are two functions of propaganda which really run sometimes contrary to each other. I mean, sometimes they can dovetail, but other times they're contrary to each other. One purpose of propaganda is to gain support so you can gain power. I mean, that's one of the things that propaganda is for. In that case, you may be willing to lie and say all sorts of things that are false just because you're wanting to gain power so that you can implement whatever programs you're really interested in. The other purpose of propaganda, however, is to try to win the public over to your position. And so in that case, you're having to, you know, tell them what you really believe if you're trying to inculcate those ideas in them. But it's difficult to tease those two things out and to decide when Hitler's doing one and when Hitler's doing the other. I mean, some places it's obvious, and I give this example in my book where when Hitler is talking about how he's a man of peace, you know, obviously in the early 1930s, especially after 1933 when he comes to power, he's telling the world, I'm a man of peace. Yes, I'm against the Versailles Treaty, but I'm gonna go about this in a peaceful way to revise it. I wouldn't think of attacking anyone. And of course, he's saying that at the same time he's telling in his private circles, and we know this again from memoirs and other things that we've had, diaries, like Goebbels' diaries that we have access to after the fact. We know that at the same time he's telling other people that, yes, we need to launch an expansionist war and prepare for it. And of course, that's by his actions we can look and see that he did that. So what I try to do is I try to compare what he was saying in public with what he was saying in private. And even what he's saying in private isn't necessarily believable either. We need to be very careful there too, because sometimes he may just have been telling even private individuals what they were wanting to hear, but then also to compare with his actions. And I think that's where the most important part is, to see if it really comports with what he was doing in terms of his policies there. And so when we look at the issues that relate to evolutionary ethics, what we find is that in the writings that seem to be the most programmatic, where Hitler does seem to be taking a position that's consistent with the way that he acted later on, and I really think that Mein Kampf and also Hitler's second book, which was never published and is just called Hitler's Second Book now, that both of those works do have a lot of material in them that is intended to teach his worldview and that did correspond with what he actually did practice once he came to power. And so I think that to a large degree, the things in those are believable. Now, interestingly, that's not the case with the Nazi 25-point program. In February 1920, the Nazi and Hitler let out and proclaimed what the Nazi 25-point program was, and actually, a number of those points Hitler did not implement once he came to power, and they weren't really that important to Hitler. Some of them were. Certainly the racist points, the expansionist points were important to Hitler, but there were other ones about capitalism, about breaking up department stores, about breaking up trusts, and a lot of anti-capitalist planks that Hitler really didn't care about so much once he came to power. And part of the reason for that, I argue, is that his real interest was ultimately in improving the biological prowess of the German people, the so-called Nordic race or Aryan race. The word Aryan and Nordic were used interchangeably by the Nazis. In fact, actually, interestingly, later in the Nazi period, they actually preferred Nordic more than Aryan. But in any case, the idea was to improve the Nordic race, to make them a superior race. He already thought they were superior, but he wanted to make them even more, improve them even more, at the expense of the so-called inferior races. And of course, within the German population, that also worked itself out into a policy of trying to promote biological progress by eliminating those with disabilities. And so there's this, it's not just focused on other races. Race was a central key aspect of Hitler's ideology. And I think Burley and Vipperman in their book Racial State, which came out in the mid-90s, I think do a great job of focusing on the way that race was central to the Nazi project. And in fact, they're not the first ones that did that. I mean, Gerhard Weinberg back in the 1970s in his book about the foreign policy of Hitler's Germany, yeah, basically laid out what was very often referred to even today, race and space, as being sort of the centerpieces of Hitler's ideology, of Nazi ideology, Hitler's ideology, Rasse und Raum. And certainly that's true. But one of the interesting things that I think I'm able to do in my book is to take a step back and ask, what is it about race and space? In fact, I sort of look at both of those elements and say there's actually something that Hitler was trying to do with both of those elements that sort of is even a higher goal of his, so to speak, in dealing with both race and space. And that is, he's trying to elevate or improve the human species by eliminating those so-called inferior races, and also then the space issue. He was trying to take over living space or Lebensraum in order to expand the German race in those areas to eliminate the inferior peoples, so-called inferior peoples there, and thus to, again, elevate the human race. Mm-hmm. And so Hitler has these utopian goals of trying to implement biological progress in a way that really does become central to his project, and it illuminates a lot of different issues in Hitler's thinking. I list in pages 8 and 9 of my introduction 6 key issues that are policies that were pretty well consistent throughout the Nazi period that Hitler was pushing forward, and I think most historians would agree with at least most of these here, despite the fact that there were, as you suggest, inconsistencies in Hitler's thought, and he had a bunch of really weird ideas about things like Herberger's ice theory and things. I actually talk about this a little bit more in the book I'm working on right now, but I focus more on the things that he did hold consistently in his worldview, in Hitler's ethic. And I list 6 issues. So one is pronatalism. That is the idea of expanding the population, trying to get more German babies. Secondly, improving the biological quality of the German people through eugenics policies. This was primarily compulsory sterilization beginning in 1933 and then later killing the disabled. The third one is expanding living space so they can expand that population into those territories where allegedly inferior peoples were living. Fourth, that inferior races have to give way to the superior ones in the struggle for existence, and so policy should always favor the Aryan or Nordic race. Fifthly, that the Jews are an inferior race, not just physically and mentally, but especially morally. And that's an interesting thing that I key in on a little bit. I'm not the first person who's done anything in this. Michael Berkowitz published a book called The Crime of My Very Existence. I think it was 2007, somewhere around there, where he talks about the fact that the Nazis viewed Jews as being born criminals, to use the term of Cesar Lombroso, who was a 19th century German psychiatrist. Interestingly, Jewish psychiatrist. who believed that certain people were born with criminal traits. Mm-hmm. And so Hitler saw the Jews in this way as being inherently immoral. And so thus, ironically, Hitler thought that killing the Jews was a way to rid the world of immorality. So you get this really weird twist here in thinking that the Aryans are supposedly more moral, according to Hitler, and the Jews are immoral, and thus by killing the Jews, you're actually advancing morality.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sixth point that I raise is that racial mixture with inferior races has to cease because it leads to biological decline. That was a point that came out of Gobineau's racial theory in the late 19th, in the mid to late 19th century,
mm-hmm.
That was becoming very popular in Germany by the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
That racial mixture was inherently negative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's stop right there. That's a good segue to the question of how did Hitler come by this worldview, this really racist, or sort of, I guess you might even call it, well, social Darwinist worldview. And you mentioned Gobineau. The idea that the races are different is a very old one, especially mm-hmm. in Western civilization. Gobineau is a good example of someone who in the mid-19th century sort of codified what we think about it. And I should also say that I know that there were efforts to explain why the races were putatively different. I mean, I seem to remember from Montesquieu that there was something about climate or something.
Yes,
I don't remember what it was.
Montesquieu did. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. Or there's some biblical explanations, Ham and all that. But what we have in the 19th century after Gobineau, because I think Darwin published this later, is the imposition of a new scientific theory that putatively explains differences in races. And then, as you point out, this gets worked up. So let's take it from its origins. And those are in Darwin himself?
Well, I would actually say that Darwin was incorporating a lot of the ideas that were already floating around, too. I mean, Robert Knox, for example, in Britain was an anatomist who was intensely racist and biological determinist already in the 1840s, 1850s. So Darwin was sort of imbibing a lot of these things too. I mean, he's not the one that originated racism. In fact, he's less racist than some of his contemporaries.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the German Darwinists were actually more racist than Darwin was as well.
Mm-hmm.
Darwin, for instance, believed that humans were one species, although he did believe that the races were unequal mentally and even morally. In fact, he actually does talk about the moral differences between races. So Darwin clearly did believe in there being racial differences. But Ernst Haeckel in Germany, who's the leading German Darwinist, took this much further than Darwin did, and so did a number of other German biologists and anthropologists afterwards as well.
Mm-hmm.
Haeckel divided the human species he claimed that the humans were actually 12 species. Well, actually, in one place it says 10, one place 12, but so he divided up differently at different times of his life, but 10 or 12 species. And he even claimed that they were so diverse that they should be divided into four separate genera. So he was really dividing the humans pretty radically, much, much more than Darwin had done. However, the basic idea was that some had evolved to higher levels than others,
mm-hmm.
And certainly this was a view that Hitler held. And interestingly, Hitler, in his 1920 speech, he gave this speech called "Why Are We Anti-Semites?" And in that speech, he gives a very interesting evolutionary explanation of the development of morality. And since I'm interested in evolutionary ethics and focusing on evolutionary ethics, this sort of caught my attention. He believed that the Nordic race had evolved to have greater morality because they had greater what is called by biologists today selective pressure. That is, he thought they'd grown up in the northern regions during the ice ages. And during these ice ages, they had had to band together and have more cooperation among themselves and work harder and have a higher work ethic in order to survive in these harsh conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Semites were living in more luxuriant, more warmer climates, thus didn't have to work as hard, didn't have to cooperate as much. And so this explains, then sort of gives an evolutionary explanation for why the Aryans have a higher morality than the Jews.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that provides a really interesting spin on that from a moral perspective.
Yeah, too. I mean, I guess I want to spend a little bit of time in just the sort of post-Darwinian era, that is after Darwin and then to Hitler. Yep. And could you take us and give us a kind of intellectual genealogy of the idea
sure.
that there are separate races, those races are in evolutionary competition,
right.
and there is some sort of group selection, and one through competition develops capacities that the other one does not?
Right. Sorry, I got off the track.
That's okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Actually, my book From Darwin to Hitler, I detail this, and I spend a lot. That's what most of my book is about. In fact, a lot of it is about. I have a whole chapter on scientific racism, and then also the racial struggle there. But in the aftermath of Darwin, there were a lot of biologists, but also a lot of social thinkers. There was Ludwig Gumplowitz, who was considered one of the early sociologists at the University of Graz in Austria, for example, who framed the idea of racial struggle. One of his books is actually entitled Racial Struggle. And although he wasn't quite as biologically determinist as some of the other ones, he did see these ethnic groups or racial groupings as being in this inherent struggle for existence with each other. And of course, he was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, where there was a lot of different ethnic groups that were competing politically at that time. And he sort of framed it in that kind of way. But there were many other biologists. And again, Ernst Haeckel was one main exemplar of this, but there were many others following after him. And by the 1890s and early 1900s, racism was going to explode, really, in the German scene. In fact, there's been some interesting studies that have looked at the way the 1890s really are a pivotal time when racism just becomes much more prominent than it had been earlier in discourse. And really, there's a time about 1900 in an anthropological profession, too. Benoit Massin has done some interesting work on German anthropology, and he shows that right around 1900, people like Virchow and others are sort of moving out of the anthropological scene, and Darwinian anthropology is moving to the fore, and it's becoming much more intensely racist at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Ludwig Boltzmann is also a very important key figure here. He began publishing a journal right at the beginning of the 1900s. He published a book called Political Anthropology in 1902 that was part of the Krupp Prize competition, which was a prize competition, a quite lucrative one, in fact, for the best answer to the question of how does Darwinism impact politics, essentially. And his answer to that was by looking at the racial struggle and how we need to promote the interests of the so-called superior race, which, of course, he thought was the Nordic race, and then also practice eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
As well. So these were just a few of the people. Theodor Fritsch also. Now, this also got integrated into the anti-Semitic scene very strongly, especially by Theodor Fritsch, who was one of the leading anti-Semitic publicists in the 1880s and thereafter. And in fact, he and Hitler actually corresponded a little bit. And so there were actually some direct connections with Hitler between Theodor Fritsch and Hitler. Not a lot, but some. And Theodor Fritsch framed the struggle between the Jews and the Germans as being a struggle for existence. In fact, even the first one to do that, Wilhelm Marr, actually, who coined the term anti-Semitism, actually had also framed anti-Semitism as being a scientific pursuit, not something based on religion, but based on race. And so what happened in the period around the 1870s, 1880s, and especially by the 1890s, there's this real strong sense that science, and especially evolutionary science, proves that races are unequal. And of course, if you think about it, I mean, this does make some kind of sense within mm-hmm. a Darwinian paradigm, because Darwinism has to have variation in order to get off the ground. There has to be variation or you're not going to get speciation.
Uh-huh.
So this then gave them impetus to even greater notions that it's scientific. Racial superiority and inferiority is a scientific construct that's proved by racial science. Let me just give another example, too, to show how this played itself out just a slightly later than, too. Konrad Lorenz, who was a Nobel Prize-winning he helped found the field of ethology, the uh-huh. study of animal behavior. Konrad Lorenz, during the Nazi period, was in Austria. Of course, it was taken over by the Nazis in 1938, so he became part of the Third Reich at that point. And he wrote an essay during the Nazi period in the early 1940s in which he argued that Darwinism was the best way to convert people to Nazi racism. because it showed that races had to be unequal.
So one of the practical results, I don't know if that's the right word, of this sort of I don't even want to call it Darwinian because it's pseudo Darwinian of this social Darwinian view of society was eugenics, and eugenics actually it goes mainstream. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Social Darwinism, I think, is the right term for it. So I think that's a good way to phrase it, because of course not every Darwinist is a social Darwinist by any stretch of the imagination. Darwinism doesn't lead inevitably into social Darwinism, but in some cases it did. That was one take that was given to it. How it fed into eugenics, interestingly, was that eugenics, of course, is not relying on natural selection. It's relying on artificial selection. You know, we're artificially deciding who is going, we as humans are going to decide who is going to, reproduce, as the whole notion behind eugenics. But the way it fed into it is that there was a profound unease by the 1890s, especially, that European society was biologically declining, that there's this decline going on. And this was in part because civilization had produced conditions that did not allow the struggle for existence to rid us of those that were biologically inferior.
Mm-hmm.
So because we have sanitation, better medical care, and other things like that, therefore people who are biologically inferior are now reproducing. And there's especially a lot of concern about mental illness being passed on. By the 1890s, there was the psychiatric profession had pretty much thrown up its hands at being able to cure a lot of mental illness and began seeing it as biologically a hereditary problem that the only thing they could do was institutionalize people and try to keep them from reproducing. And so in the psychiatric community in particular, there was a lot of emphasis on eugenics to try to cut down on mental illness, mental disability in the coming generations. Now, of course, this would, in many cases, people were simply calling for restrictions on reproduction, such as compulsory sterilization. But then it also radicalized in some cases where people began pushing also for killing the disabled, infanticide, or so-called euthanasia.
So this was more or less common coin among right-thinking people in that era.
Say that again.
I was going to say this is more or less common coin. That is, it's kind of common belief among right-thinking people,
especially
people like you and me. You know, like we'd believe this.
Yeah, especially among progressives in the medical profession and psychiatric community, most prominently there. And of course, in the United States, California, where I'm sitting right now, I had a compulsory sterilization program too. So it was actually prominent in the United States as well. There were quite a number of states that had it, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1927 in the Buck versus Bell decision that compulsory sterilization was perfectly legitimate and that states could do it.
So take us from this set of ideas to Hitler. How does he get it? I mean,
Hitler doesn't talk a lot about the people he read. One of the few people he tells us he read was Schopenhauer. During World War I, he claims he carried around the full five-volume set of Schopenhauer's works in his backpack and read them and was enthused about them. But he really doesn't talk a lot about who he read, I think in part because he wants to portray himself as being a more original kind of thinker. But he's not an original thinker by any stretch of the imagination. All of the ideas that he puts forward are very common in the German scene before him and around him. And it's difficult to know if he got these ideas in Vienna, which he very easily could have. Brigitte Hamann, in her book Hitler's Vienna, does a great job looking at the press in Vienna during the period he was there from 1907 to 1913, also looking at just the general intellectual culture there in the kind of circles that Hitler would have been around and such. And his roommate at the very beginning of that, Kubizek, testifies that Hitler was always with books. He was constantly reading. So we do know that he read a lot. Now, what he read is another matter. And I think he probably read, and it seems that he probably did read more periodical stuff, newspapers. He probably got more of his stuff secondhand, thirdhand, than directly from some of these key thinkers. But there was certainly plenty of places he could have received these ideas from. There's one book that came out in the 1950s called The Man Who Gave Hitler His Ideas. It actually is not published in English, it's published in German, Der Mann, Hitler, die Ideen gab, which claims that Jürg Lanz von Liebenfels, who was a Viennese occultist, Aryan supremacist, was the guy that gave Hitler all his ideas. And if you read Lanz von Liebenfels' works, which I have, and compare them with Hitler's ideas, there are a lot of parallels. I mean, it's very striking, the parallels there, and you can understand why someone would think that Hitler got his ideas from this guy. However, we don't have any strong evidence that Hitler ever read those things. It's possible. In fact, I think it's likely he may have. But what's striking, if you look at other things outside of Lanz von Liebenfels, is that those same ideas were circulating in a lot of other circles, too. It wasn't just Lanz von Liebenfels. So I don't think there was any one person that gave Hitler's ideas. I think he got ideas from a lot of different sources that were out there, and there were certainly a lot of them available to him, both in Vienna during that period, 1907 to 1913, and then also in Munich, after he moved to Munich in 1913, and then after the war also, either during or after the war, there was a lot of those ideas circulating out there. One of the periodicals that I look at in both in Hitler's ethic that Hitler almost certainly read was called Deutschlands Erneuerung, which means Germany's renewal. And in that periodical was published by a friend of Hitler's. It was edited by the man who was the main speaker at the first meeting where Hitler spoke to the German Workers' Party, which became the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Hitler in 1922 sent out a circular message telling all his party members they should read this journal. Hitler actually published an article in it after the Völkischer Beobachter was banned after the Beer Hall Putsch. So there's strong circumstantial evidence that Hitler read this journal. I mean, we know that he approved of it. We know that. And if you read this journal, Deutschlands Erneuerung, which I have, I haven't read obviously straight through every single copy, but I've read a lot of articles from it. The articles in there contain almost all of the major ideas of Hitler's work: eugenics, racism, the biological racism, evolutionary ethics. In fact, there's an article that actually is in Hitler's library, so we know that Hitler owned it. We can't know for sure if he read it, but we know that he owned it, by Fritz Lenz, who was a leading geneticist in Germany. It was published in 1917 in Deutschlands Erneuerung, and it's about evolutionary ethics, and talking about the ethic of race. About a racial ethic. Mm-hmm. And so there were lots of sources that Hitler could have got this from. And another thing, too, is while Hitler was in prison after after his failed beer hall putsch, Julius Friedrich Lehmann, who is the publisher of Deutschlands Erneuerung, his son-in-law was also interned in Landsberg, too, with Hitler. So, I mean, there's a lot of connections there. So Hitler had lots of opportunity to learn these things from a variety of sources, mm-hmm. and I think he did get them from a wide variety of sources.
Mm-hmm. So the – I don't know if it's the central thesis, but one of the main themes of your book is, in fact, this notion of evolutionary morality. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, it's basically – well, actually, there's two kinds of takes on this notion of evolution and morality. First of all is that it provides an explanation for where morality came, and I also indicated that a little bit earlier in this talk where I mentioned that Hitler thought that morality had evolved by the harsh conditions the Aryans were struggling against, and therefore they become more cooperative. And so that's an evolutionary explanation for morality. But beyond that, and even more importantly, I think, in Hitler's worldview, is his central focus in everything he was doing was to try to promote biological progress. And so this notion that we need to evolve humans to a higher level, this is really animating a lot of what Hitler is about. Now, of course, one of the key things that's built into his particular view of evolutionary ethics that people who imbibe evolutionary ethics today would disagree with, because, of course, evolutionary ethics is actually in a resurgence mode today since the 1970s. But, of course, the versions of evolutionary ethics today are not racist like Hitler's was. So Hitler has this particular racist vision of evolutionary ethics that thinks that because the Nordic race is higher already, therefore one of the best ways to advance the human species is to destroy those who are inferior to the Nordic race, and thus expand the living space of the Nordic race out, and that then will promote biological progress.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, one question that I had when reading this, I certainly accept everything you said, and maybe Hitler never considered this, but I did, and that is, it seems to jump the is-ought divide rather cavalierly. And that
yes,
is,
it does.
It may be the case that nations are struggling with one another, or have heretofore. And it may even be the case that this has resulted in varying characteristics for those so-called races. That's all is. But that they should, and that we have to, that's a leap. So how does does he ever consider this, or how does he get there?
I don't think he does ever consider it, and I certainly agree with you about that. I mean, I think you're right. I think you're spot on. I mean, you got it right. But one thing that Hitler does do, and if you read in reading Mein Kampf, and a number of other historians have noticed this as well. I mean, Hitler does believe that morality is based on nature. So, I mean, he does sort of address that in a sense, but he just sort of ignores any counter arguments. He just claims that it is based on nature. And, you know, I'm not certain that this is the only reason why, but this sort of sinks into what the work I'm doing right now. I'm doing a book right now on Hitler's religion. And in that, I argue that Hitler was a pantheist in that book. Uh-huh. And so nature is God for Hitler.
Uh-huh.
So this means that for him, there is no is-ought divide. Nature determines what ought to be. And so I think that's why Hitler sort of is able to leap over the is-ought divide, because of his pantheistic view.
All I can think is that's wacky. Not only dangerous, but just wacky. Anyway, so how does this belief in evolutionary morality, and this is basically the rest of the book, manifest itself in Hitler's various policies? For example, you talk about socialism and sexual morality and population expansion, reproduction, and these various things. Can you go through those?
Sure. Yeah. There's been a lot of work done on the eugenics movement, and I've already mentioned that to some degree. And also, I've also mentioned just toward the beginning about the living space, expanding the living space. I've already hit on a few of these, Tim, but maybe one of the more interesting ones that hasn't been dealt with in any length in any scholarly works before this time, in the way that I do, and linking it to the evolutionary ethics especially, is the notion of his socialism, his ideas about socialism. Mm-hmm. That is, Hitler believed that the German people also needed to compete among each other. So he believes that there's this competition going on, this struggle for existence. And he thinks this competition has to go on not only between races, but even within races. And so he actually does think, even though he sort of plays down a lot of time the inter-German competition, in the sense of, you know, he's really wanting to focus that most of his attention on the struggle for existence against the other races. So he's wanting to build this camaraderie among the German people. At the same time, his notion of the leadership principle, or the Führerprinzip, leads him to see that there does need to be competition within Germany too, to who's going to become part of that leadership too. And so there is this then competition among Germans themselves for who's going to rise in rise in the political sphere, social sphere, economic sphere, and such be on top. And so there's this notion that competition is a good thing, and we need to do everything we can to let that work. Now, one thing in terms of his socialism, though, because he believes it's biologically, it should be biologically defined, he does want to try to introduce ways of leveling society so that everyone has an equal opportunity to thrive and to show whether they are part of that biological elite. So that's why they want to promote universal education, which they are extraordinary. Had, but that was one thing that they were very interested in, making it more egalitarian in society. They were interested in promoting help to the indigent Germans, as long as they're biologically, you know, have the right biological character. They wanted to sort of iron out the socioeconomic inequalities that were not based on biology, and wanting to make all of the inequalities to be based on biology.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of one way that they sort of promoted. So they promoted a lot of different kind of policies that also fed into eugenics movements, pronatalism. They gave marriage loans to healthy Germans to try to promote more early marriage so that they could hopefully get more babies. As it turns out, it only worked marginally. Matter of fact, it didn't work. Actually, probably what really worked was they got the economy going, and that's probably what got them actually a little bit more population increase by the mid-1930s. And of course, then they lost all that during the war too. So the war actually obviously backfired on him. But then it also drove their policies in compulsory sterilization, killing of the disabled, beginning in 1939-40, when they implemented that, was again a way to sort of rid themselves of what they considered inferior biological specimens, so that the superior Germans could thrive. In fact, there's a very interesting speech that Hitler gave in 1929 where he deals with this issue of infanticide, and he actually gives the outrageous figure there. He says that if we eliminated 700,000 to 800,000 out of every million Germans born, 700,000 to 800,000 of the weakest Germans born, this actually would strengthen our nation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a pretty 70 to 80% elimination through infanticide is pretty. I don't think he's suggesting it as a policy proposal, but still is pretty radical and still shows where his mindset was, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you talk about war. Obviously, he has this sort of grand plan that is at least informed by this ideology. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I spent a chapter talking about his expansionist warfare. He's trying to expand his living space so that he can eliminate the so-called inferior races in those places and replace them with the Germans. And not just Germans, though. And this is interesting, too. There's been a lot of good work done recently about the so-called racial state, although this is still a contentious issue. Historians are still debating over to what extent Nazism was a racial state. In fact, at the German Studies Association conference of that last fall, there were a number of sessions that were dealing with, was Nazism a racial state? To what extent it was. I believe it was. I believe race was central. But basically, it wasn't just the Jews that they were trying to eliminate from those places. Ultimately, they wanted to eliminate the Slavs, the Gypsies, obviously. They targeted them very strongly because they – and the Jews and the Slavs – excuse me, the Jews and the Gypsies were targeted more than the Slavs because they were considered more inferior, more of a threat, and also they were considered to have more, quote, Asiatic elements. The Slavs were considered somewhat superior to the Jews, but still inferior to the Nordic race, and so they were considered good for slave labor for the time, but ultimately they would get eliminated too in the long-range scheme of things, ultimately. So the notion was to expand in those territories. Now, what's interesting here too is that it wasn't just the Germans, though. It was also the Norwegians. Who they were, of course, occupying, the Danes, they were occupying Denmark, the Dutch, and who are also defined as Nordic, they were also being defined as part of this racial community. And there was strong emphasis on trying to recruit SS men from the Scandinavian mm-hmm. countries and also from Holland, and also to recruit settlers from those areas to go into Poland to take over those territories that were being occupied. So there's a very strong focus on settlement in those areas, which, interestingly, Germans were not as interested in this as Hitler was. Hitler was very interested in this. The Germans mostly were not all that interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at the German economy, too, and I think Richard Bessel does a good job of this in his book Nazism and War, talking about this, too. The German economy was completely focused in the 1930s on expansionism. Hitler wanted to get the economy going not to provide more consumer goods for the people. And this becomes very clear by the 1937 when he initiates his four-year plan. The four-year plan, and if you read the original plan that Hitler wrote out, the original sketch of the plan for the four-year plan, it's completely focused on expansionism into areas to take over those territories to spread German settlers in those areas. German agriculture is supposed to go there. And this is all based on this idea of a racial struggle for existence going on. And there's a limited space. We need to expand the population. The only way to do that is to take over more land.
Mm-hmm. So let's come to the Holocaust right now. And is there something special about the Jews for Hitler? Do they stand out for some reason?
Yes. And it really doesn't have anything to do with evolutionary ethics, though. It just happened – the Jews, by the 1870s, there's this secularized form of anti-Semitism that is taking over all of the old prejudices and stereotypes that the Jews have suffered under for centuries, that has been born through the Christian anti-Semitism, the centuries of that. And it's becoming secularized to define the Jews as a race. And so Hitler sees this, that the Jews and the Germans as being this racial competition. But part of the way this competition runs, the way that in Hitler's view, is that the Jews are trying to dominate the German economy. They're trying to take control of the press. They're trying to take control of all the cultural aspects of German society. They're also trying to intermarry and intermingle their race with the Germans to undermine and destroy the German race. And there's also this international conspiracy going on. I mean, Hitler was a true believer in this international conspiracy idea that Rosenberg and others especially brought to Germany with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was brought to Germany by some Russian emigres. right about right after 1919, 1920. And Hitler's a true believer in all of that. And so Hitler sees them as being racial enemies. And, of course, he uses incredibly virulent language toward them. He calls them bacillus. He calls them parasites and all sorts of things like that, because he sees them as being a biological entity that is in biological competition with the German race. And so the only way to deal with that is to eliminate them one way or another. And there's, of course, a lot of disputes among German historians as to when Hitler actually decided to eliminate them through killing, mass execution. It does seem likely that Hitler actually was trying early on to simply deport as many as possible, and would have probably been satisfied with that. I mean, ultimately, it was a genocidal idea anyway, because he sees this universal struggle for existence going on, which ultimately does have to result in the death to the so-called inferior, and then the thriving of the superior. Mm-hmm. But it's not clear that Hitler thought he was going to do that, you know, within the first few years, or even right at the beginning of the war. And when the war broke out in 1939, Hitler was even talking at that point about sort of having reservations similar to like American Indian reservations being set up in eastern Poland, where the Jews are going to get sent there. Yeah. And then, of course, the Madagascar plan. There's this Madagascar plan at 1.2 that the SS is hatching to try to send all the Jews to Madagascar. But again, these still were ultimately genocidal in the sense that it's not clear that they were going to kill the Jews immediately, but it still was the notion that eventually they're going to die off.
I have a couple of sort of final questions. One of them is, to what degree, and maybe this is an impossible question, did sort of ordinary Germans, that's a phrase that German historians like to use. I never quite know what it means, but ordinary Germans, did they buy into this? Do they think that this was something that ought to be done? Eugenics and, you know, Lebensraum and you know, killing the Jews and you know, subjugating the Slavs and so on and so forth.
That's a great question, and we're still working on that, I think, to a large degree. I'll say a couple things about it, though. One, I think Peter Fritsch, an interesting book called Germans into Nazis, talks about the role of nationalism in recruiting people to Nazism in the period between World War I and 1933. And I think he has a really good point. But one of the points he makes, interestingly, is that he claims that a lot of the Germans were not on board with the racialist eugenics and the biological determinism stuff. They were on board with the nationalism. And this is where Hitler was able to use words that were ambiguous to his advantage. The word Volk, for example, the word German Volk, which means people as an ethnic identity, that the German nationalists were using to identify themselves as the German Volk, that word by the early 20th century was ambiguous, because it could mean just an ethnic identity, those that speak German and read Goethe and have a German education, etc. But it also had come to mean by that time a racial identity. And again, this is why Hitler, once World War II breaks out, he's actually very willing to allow the Norwegians, the Danes, the Dutch into his Volksgemeinschaft, his people's community. Because for him, the folk isn't defined by whether you speak German. For Hitler, the folk is defined by whether you are part of the Nordic race, at least what he thinks of the Nordic race. Again, that was ill-defined too. That was a problem for them to define too. But still, they at least thought they could define it as being the German race. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of people who were not on board with all of those ideas. On the other hand, there were a lot of intellectual elites, especially in the medical profession, who were. And what's striking, if you read like Ulf Schmidt's recent biography of Karl Brandt, for example, or there's some really good work that's been done recently on medical ethics, Andreas Frever and some of his students, Florian Bruns is one, have written some interesting stuff on medical ethics under the Nazi period. And they pretty much confirm the kind of position that I take by showing the role of social Darwinism and such in the medical ethics of the doctors who were there during the Nazi period. And this is why, just to give you one kind of example, after the Americans had liberated a insane asylum in Bavaria, I'm thinking it was Kaufbeuren, but I could be wrong, maybe somewhere else, the physician, the psychiatrist there continued killing the disabled. They continued the program of killing the disabled after it was already liberated because they were completely on board with that. And when Hitler gave the orders to carry out the killing of the disabled, the people he assigned that task were completely sympathetic, not only sympathetic, but very zealous to go out and do that. So there were enough people on board that they were able to do it. In terms of the issue of anti-Semitism, that's sort of the even bigger issue there, and that it seems to me that anti-Semitism was pretty rampant within the German population, but most of the people were not foreseeing the killing of the Jews, even though many of them were not did not have any problems, let's say, with discriminatory measures.
Mm-hmm. So my final question before I close is this. And it relates to the question I just asked. The vast majority, the vast majority of Germans at that time were Christians. Hitler, I guess, was brought up a Christian. I don't know to what extent, but all of these things are in conflict with Christianity. I don't know. They just all are. So was Hitler a Christian?
Actually, my book I'm working on right now on Hitler's religion addresses this theme. In fact, there are three main views of Hitler's religion and that are out there sort of in the – especially in the popular world. Now, a lot of scholars know better than this, but there's a lot of sort of three main views. One is that Hitler was a Christian. A lot of the atheist websites push that view. One is that Hitler was an atheist. There are a lot of Christian websites that push that view. And one of them is Hitler was an occultist into astrology and all sorts of occult stuff.
That's the History Channel view.
Yeah, there you go. That's about it, yeah. None of those three is correct. Hitler was clearly anti-atheist, which he made clear on lots of occasions. He was clearly anti-Christian, at least in any sense that would be recognizable as Christianity. He does talk about Jesus in a positive way in certain times, but he didn't believe that Jesus was God. He didn't believe that Jesus did any miracles or rose from the dead. He did think that Jesus was an anti-Semite. He thought Jesus was an Aryan anti-Semite. And his favorite story about Jesus, by the way, was the driving of the Jews out of the temple, driving the money-grubbing Jews, his view, out of the temple with a whip. So Jesus is this great Aryan fighter, and he's ultimately martyred for doing that.
Right.
So that's sort of his image. But after that, he thought that Paul had corrupted Christianity, and so that from the time of Paul on, he thought Christianity was totally sunk. And he specifically mentions the issue of Christianity, Christian ethics. And I spent a whole chapter, in fact, in my book, Hitler's Religion, discussing the intersection of Hitler's ethics and Christian ethics. Mm-hmm. Because Hitler made very clear that he despised Christian ethics of sympathy for the weak, helping the poor, and such, which he thought would bring about biological decline. It had brought about biological decline to the German people. Mm-hmm. In terms of the occultists, too, Hitler was also very anti-occult and anti-paganist, too, and he actually spoke behind Himmler and Hess and others who did have some occult and neo-paganist tendencies. Hitler actually spoke against them behind their backs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get on the History Channel with that. I'm sorry to say, Richard.
You know what? I actually was contacted by someone who was doing a documentary on Nazism and the occult, and they once they found out my position, I didn't hear any more from them.
Yeah, that's right. You're just not going to. No, that's not going to get any viewers. That kind of thing. Well, like I said, you have to if you want attention, you have to say outrageous things that probably aren't true. And as you since you're not willing to do that, you're not going to get on the History Channel. So today we've been. Today we've been talking with Richard Weichert about his book, Hitler's Ethic, The Nazi Pursuit of Evolutionary Progress. And Richard, let me thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And you've already talked about your final project, so we can't ask that question. We know that you're working on a book about Hitler's religion. When is that book due?
I've got the manuscript, a rough draft of the manuscript done, so I'm hoping maybe it'll hit the shelves within maybe, I don't know, 2 years?
2 years.
A year and a half, 2 years, something like that.
That's
it takes time to revise. I'll have to revise it still. I've sent it out to some scholars to get some feedback now, so I'm waiting to hear back.
I'll wait to hear back from them. Well, I hope we get to have you back on when that's done. I'm sure I'll read that book.
That'll be great.
It's very interesting. So thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And let me say to everyone who listens to this podcast and the other podcasts on the New Books Network, thank you very much for listening in, and I hope you have a great week.